Welcome to episode 67 of the Payers and Players podcast. Scott, how you doing today?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing good. Scott, why don't you introduce our guest to everybody?
Great. Today we have on the podcast Cooper Williams and his fitness coach, Richard Woodruff. Richard is the director at Raw Tennis Performance, one of the best accounts that I've seen on Instagram. He has a bunch of videos with him and Cooper doing some training, so we'll get to that in a bit. But first we'll start off with we're talking to Cooper and get a little bit about his tennis background. And then we'll bring Richard in for some fitness talk. But as to introduce Cooper, Cooper is, I believe, a 16-year-old. Who's one of the top 16-year-olds in the world. He won the boys 14 hard courts a couple years ago. He played in La Petite Ace and has been competing at the ITF level more recently. So if I got that right, Cooper, why don't you? Yeah. So Cooper, can you maybe give us your tennis background, how you got started in tennis, and then we'll go from there.
Sure, of course. I played pretty much every sport before tennis. I played football, basketball, golf, swimming, all of it. I mean, and you know, tennis just clicked for me. I didn't really start playing competitively till I was about, I want to say eight or nine, but I'd picked it up when I was seven, and I really enjoyed it. And you know, I got quite good at it, so you know, it really took off. I went to an all boys British school on the Upper East Side. Called St. Bernard's till I was in seventh grade. So, you know, I would be playing weekend tournaments and coming back on Mondays and doing all that. And at some point my travel got, the schedule just got too big, just too much for me to handle while doing, you know, in-person school. I was still doing well in school. It's just, I'd spend, you know, 2 weeks at Le Petit and then, you know, a week at Orange Bowl, and it became a little too much. So, you know, I played a lot of USTA till I was about 13. And then I kind of transferred, you know, I won a bunch of like doubles nationals and stuff. And I won hard court singles, as you said, but I transferred to the ITF circuit mainly when I was around 14. And then I really started playing when I was about 15 last year. And I think I'm like 130 now after JB1. So yeah, it's been good progress.
That's really good progress. And one of the things that you notice is, you know, maybe when you're 12 years old, you weren't maybe the top in your group, but by the time you're 14, you had, you know, like you said, you won nationals, you participated in La Petite Ace. So what do you think helped make that improvement from 12 to 14? Was it something in your game style? Was it, you know, maybe maturity, or, but what do you attribute that jump to?
Well, honestly, I think it's a little weird, because the difference between the 12s level and the 14s level, no, it's not like, you know, 12 defines your career, 14s define your career, which doesn't, but the jump from like the USTA circuit to more the ITF is just like the kids get stronger. You're playing 18 and under. You just have to play a bigger game. You're not going to be able to, you know, sit back and just kind of, you know, make balls. It works in the 12s. It may work, you know, in the, you know, not so great 14s, but yeah. I mean, once you play in the ITF circuit, it's just, you have to bring the game to these guys. And obviously, you know, your competitors, the group of your competitors expands. You know, I was always like, oh, it's great to be, you know, top five and number one in the US. And as soon as I started playing ITFs, I was like, there are 100 kids my year who are competing for that same spot as me, you know, and we're all just like, you know, fighting for this, you know, a higher ranking. And they're great players, and it's actually really good to compete with these guys, you know, foreign players as well.
Yeah, for sure. You know, so tell us a little bit about some of those international experiences. You know, you said you played La Petite Ace. What was the qualifying like for that? How does, if to someone who doesn't know, how do you get selected for some of these tournaments?
Right. So I actually played the qualifying twice in the U.S. I played for the 04 year, which I did not end up making. I know Victor, Jonah, Evan, and I think John Kim went. And I played the qualifying there. Great experience. You know, they put you up in obviously a very nice hotel. It's very serious. It's a very big tournament. It's probably the biggest 14 and under tournament in the world at any time. Mm-hmm. But yes, the next year, the 05 year, I played and I qualified with three other guys. And, you know, it's a huge thing. And that year they actually, the USA didn't take us. So we had to go with our parents, which was fine. It is what it is. But we went, and it's just, as soon as you get there, it's just like, you're signing autographs. You're treated like a professional tennis player pretty much. So it was really awakening for sure. I mean, I'd never really done anything like that. So it was definitely a little freaky, but you know, I went there, I ended up winning doubles there with Kyle, and it was a great experience. I lost in the round of 16 of singles to the guy, you know, who had match points in the finals. Wow. But it was a ridiculous experience. You know, as soon as we got off the court after just winning like a first round match, you're signing autographs, you're taking pictures, you know, it's, and I was 13 years old. Yeah. It was like, what is this? This is crazy.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. It's great that there's such a tournament and such fan support at the local level for that. You know, I'm not sure that we could generate that in the US, but it seems like there's some history in that town where it's held that, you know, they really embrace that. And it's a great experience for all the 13, 14 year olds to feel like, you know, they're how professional tennis players must feel.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, and a lot of those kids actually, it's different in Europe. I think a lot of those kids did end up signing pro, you know? So it's definitely like, it gives the US kids a bit of like, wow, this is how they treat it, you know, halfway across the world.
Right.
Scott, I don't know if you remember, we talked to Connor Glennon, who is from the UK, and he played in La Petite Os probably, I would say it was probably 15 years ago. And do you remember he described it? He was like, man, I walked in and it was like a horse barn. They turned into a tennis court. You know,
that is exactly right.
So tell us a little more about the environment.
Right. So it's in the middle of nowhere, France. I mean, I'd love to tell you it was in, you know, Paris, right next to you. Like, it was a beautiful, it was freezing cold in the middle of January, in a couple barns side by side, and you know, walk in, and it's like they set up like food stands and stuff. I mean, but it's packed as soon as you walk in there. But you drive like 45 minutes from the airport, and you're flatland, nothing, and there's like a gate with like an armed guard or something. You drive in, and it's just like three sheds pretty much next to each other. And the crazy thing was, you play in one and it'd be freezing cold in that one, and then the main one would have great heaters, so you know, you'd sweat, and then the third one would play like a completely different court than the other two. So it was like you never knew what you were going to get with this place. But I mean, it definitely helped it was definitely a surprise factor for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, so I know that you've had a lot of ITF experience in the last year. I wonder if you could tell us some of your stories from playing over there and some of the crazy experiences that you've encountered.
Right. So, I've pretty much been to a lot of places in Europe, and I can firmly say that Europe is just ridiculously strong. The level over there is very, very strong. And it's not the same as you get, you know, in South America or the US. But yeah, I've played in, Sweden, Slovenia, and I mean, I played on carpet. I played on two types of carpet, actually. I played on acrylic and like the rug you roll out in your basement.
How do those play? Super fast?
I wouldn't describe it as tennis, to be honest. It plays like ice. I mean, and the ball just doesn't bounce. It kind of just rolls. So if you have a good serve and you volley well, you're gonna do great. But I was, you know, 15 when I played. I didn't quite have the serve I do now. But it was definitely interesting because some kids in Europe, they play on it a lot and they know how to play on it.
Right. And I've heard like some of the players, they use like only continental grips because everything is so low and so fast. And then when they come over here, they've got to learn to hit a topspin forehand because they never hit one before.
And they just chip all their backhands, a slice of forehands, come to net, serve, overhead. Yeah. Right. But other places, I just got back from Egypt a couple weeks ago.
Tell me about your mom mentioned that you went over there by yourself. Is that right?
I went with a family friend and one other player.
Okay. And so you guys pretty much stayed in the hotel the entire, you're there for 3 weeks, right?
Yeah. Three weeks of going hotel to site, hotel to grocery store back to hotel. And that was all it consisted of. Cause you know, all the food, cause they do it. If you play higher level ICFs, you play grade ones, A's, twos, you get hospitality. So there's no real reason to have to leave the hotel, you know, especially when you're traveling with like a coach or, you know, a family friend as I did. But I went with another kid and we played doubles and we did really well. I quartered the two grade twos, but, you know, it's not easy. You got to eat chicken and rice, you know, 3 weeks, and it's not like they're giving you a whole, you know, spread of different foods. And I'm not a picky eater. I love food. Some countries you don't quite know what you're going to get because, you know, you can't really drink the water either because it's not as safe as it is in the US or in Europe or something. But you know, you have to take precautions and stuff. So you can never be too careful.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and so I know you don't drink the water and you got to take your pills and everything. And so it's got to be a little bit dangerous playing over there, knowing if you get sick, you know, you're out for a few days. So you got to be really careful mm-hmm. with what you eat and what you drink. Yeah. Cool. Hey, let's try and bring Richard into this. I wanted to talk a little bit, you know, about your sort of typical training day, but I'll ask Richard, you know, how did you start working with Cooper and how did you sort of conduct an assessment and sort of identify what he needs?
So Cooper came to me at the beginning of this year and he was referred to me from, as he was moving down here, he was referred to me from an agent that I've worked with in the past. So your typical assessment evaluation, you come in, we go through, I watch you do some movements, some movement patterns, so I can see where you have any weaknesses, anything like that. And then we sit down and we talk about where you are with your game, where you're going, what are you working on with your game. And so then we put together a program based on that. So like for Cooper, he's already taller than me. He's like 6'2". So we need to make sure that he's getting stronger. As he mentioned, when you're playing ITFs, you're playing, you know, guys that are 17, 18 years old, and, you know, they can really hit the ball, and he's got to be able to handle that as well. So we've been working on getting him a little bit stronger, getting him stronger through his legs, but at the same time, not bulking him up too much. Of course, every program that we have is based on injury prevention as well. So we do a lot of stability work, a lot of mobility work with him. And that's pretty much where he is now. We will set forth, a calendar program for him where during this time we need to work on getting him bigger. During this time, we're going to work on his explosiveness. During this time, we're going to work on his footwork, his agility. So that's kind of how we'll set him up.
Forward. So Richard, you're describing basically periodization, right? So can you talk a little more about periodization for the listeners and why it's important?
The hard part with tennis is there's no off season. So if you think in terms of a football player, a baseball player, a basketball player, a hockey player, they have an off season. So they come out of their season and they can just do a straight line periodization. Okay, we're going to come in and we work through the off season building towards their training camp. Problem with tennis players is they don't really have an off season. So a lot of times we have to pick our spots. So with periodization, we're going to do what's called undulating periodization. So we have to kind of mix around a little bit more, and we'll pick those times when, for example, with Cooper, we want to have a period where we've got maybe 4 weeks where we can focus on his hypertrophy. So we can work on getting him a little bit bigger, a little bit stronger. When he's playing he's got some clay court events coming up. We want to make sure that the legs are strong enough, but we want to make sure that we're not overdoing it. We figure the points are going to be a little bit longer. When he's going to come back and play on some of those indoor carpets in Europe, where we know it's going to be fast and quick, we're going to work on staying down a little bit, but that's also a time we can work on his explosiveness. So that's how a periodization plan would work.
So your plan really is centered around the surfaces that he'll be playing on.
Yes, and the time frame. So, you know, right. He's on a schedule where he's got, like, for example, he's got four big tournaments coming up. He's got the two tournaments in Mexico, followed by Eddie Herr and the Orange Bowl. So that's a time that we wouldn't train through that. We might have a couple of tournaments where we're going to train through those. Maybe it's a J2, a J3 that he's playing. Even some of the futures that he's starting to play, like he's got coming up, we'll work through those. But our goal is to go ahead and start getting him on a plan like we would have if he was playing on the pro tour, where we're going to pick certain tournaments where we want him to be peaking, and we're going to make sure that the plan is set up for that.
So, for example,
I know Cooper has a goal for next year of playing the junior slams. So obviously we pencil those in straight away and we want to be peaking for those.
If you play a more minor tournament along the way, obviously you're not peaking, so it's not as big of a focus, but the ultimate goal is at those junior slams to be at your very best.
Exactly. So by playing through, I mean, he'll be doing a lot. Some of the other tournaments, he might be on the road, but he'll still be training as he's playing and competing in those.
Well, and I think what you're describing is important because I've said this before too, but it's hard for parents to understand. No athlete, no tennis player or any other sport can be at their best all the time, right?
Correct.
So talk about that, because a lot of them don't understand why that is. They why not? I mean, you're just playing, hitting a tennis ball. So kind of explain why you agree with me on that.
Well, first of all, everyone has ups and downs. You know, you have a good day, you have a bad day, you have a good week, you have a bad week. It's you can't be at your peak physically. And if you're playing on tour, if you're playing a schedule like these guys like Cooper are playing, you're going to have, you know, little aches and pains here and there. And we can't work on everything all at once. Well, you know, you need to be stronger. You need to be faster. You need to be quicker. I can't work on all of that at one time. So we pick our spots for and how we're going to go about that training. So the other thing too is that, you know, like I said, Cooper's got four tournaments in a row coming up. So if he goes away and all he does is play matches for 4 weeks, he's going to have lost any of the strength gains. He's going to start to lose strength gains, for example. So that's why it's important for him to maintain some of that while he's playing, while he's on the road and getting some of that work in. It doesn't mean that he's in there, like in the weight room, just crushing it and going for PRs every time, but he's doing maintenance work. He's doing, you know, minimal effective dosage. And that's how you need to do. That's how you need to do it when you're on the road playing, so that when you come back, you're not starting from zero again. And a lot, like I said, a lot of what we do is based on injury prevention, because that's the first goal. If he's not healthy, he's not on the court playing, he's not doing what he wants to do. So all of those things that he's going to do on the road are going to help him stay healthy. And when he comes back into the gym, comes back into town to train, we're not starting over again.
All right. So let me ask you this. And I got a follow up after you answer it. Most people, I think, agree, but I want to hear your perspective. Most people would agree that generally, from a weight training perspective, you have to lift 4 days a week to really see gains and maybe 2 days a week to maintain those gains. Do you agree with that in a tennis perspective?
It depends on what your goal is. If your goal is hypertrophy, then you've got to lift a little bit heavier. You've got to adjust your reps and sets. If your goal is to maintain the strength that you have, you don't need to lift four times a week. Like you said, you need two times a week. You can work in, you know, your full body work. It also will depend a little bit on the athlete, but and again, what the goals are. But generally for tennis, you know, we don't need to do a whole lot of upper body heavy weights. That's not what we want to do. We do a lot of band work. We'll do a lot of high rep work and working with the right ratio for posterior anterior.
That's important. That posterior anterior is super important, so you don't get out of balance. Would you agree?
Absolutely. A big part of it too is that, you know, I think that the term sport specific training is maybe a little overused, but definitely a little bit misunderstood. So for example, Cooper spends his day on court hitting tennis balls, hitting ground strokes, hitting serves. Basically what he's doing with his arms is he's doing internal rotation again and again and again. So when he's working
those frontal muscles, pecs,
correct.
Right, biceps, everything on the front side of his body, he's working. And correct. So then, like you say, when he lifts, he needs to work the stuff on the backside, his back, his shoulders.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. That's exactly right. Because we need to open him back up. And he doesn't like to hear that because, yeah, he wants to come in the gym and you know, and he wants to do bench press and curls.
Yeah. Bench press and curls, baby.
That's right. I call it the beach workout. He wants to look good at the beach. He wants to take his shirt off when he goes to the beach.
Well, I mean, who doesn't want to? Cooper, Cooper, you're younger than me and Scott. I don't blame you, man.
We're in Florida. You got to have it.
Yeah.
We're do in it Florida, while you can. He said. Yeah, Scott's right. Do it while you can.
And I know when he's ready for that workout because he comes in with his cutoff t-shirt on. You know, he's like, suns out.
Yeah. Yep. Good. Well, so the follow-up I have to that is, Richard, because I think you're full of a ton of really good information, and I think Cooper's lucky to have you really looking out for him in these areas, because there's a lot of ways that if not doing what you're doing could cause other injuries. But my follow-up is, you know, at what point with a young kid do you start doing this? Now, I hear some people say an age, and I hear some people say really a biological age. You know, wait till you start seeing some puberty setting in. What are your thoughts? I mean, I know you can do bands. I know you can do some PT-style injury prevention type stuff. But at what point do you start doing what Cooper would call his guns out or suns out, guns out workout, where he's really starting to do some curls and bench press and that kind of stuff?
I look at it, it's a combination. Yes, the biological age plays into it, where you are, if you know where you are with your HPV as far as coming through puberty, but also your training age. So if you know, if you come in and you're 15, 16 years old biologically, but you haven't been doing prior, you know, any kind of band work, any kind of strength work like that, that's where we've got to start. But if you come in and you've been doing that from a younger age, then you'll be ready to take that on. There is no problem with prepubescent kids starting to lift weights and do strength training. The only thing for me is, from a tennis standpoint, making sure that we're doing the right ones.
Right. Well, let me flip back to Cooper here really quick. I'm just curious, Cooper, what is your typical training day in terms of, you know, when you get up, practice, conditioning with Richard, meals, school, et cetera? Walk us through sort of what your normal day looks like.
Right. So, you know, we're in Florida and the rain is definitely a factor. So, but normally with my coach, we'd go from 9 to 11:30. Would be a normal practice time. And then, you know, I come home, have lunch, try to get maybe an hour in or an hour or hour and a half of work in before I go to Richard. Usually go to Richard around 2 or 3 and we'll go for, you know, an hour, a little over an hour. And then I'll probably come home and just grind the homework, have dinner and just kind of relax a bit.
So those practices in the morning, are you doing any match play in that, or is it just drills with your coach, or
right? So a normal week, actually, I'll probably play in the morning, you know, 4 out of 5 days. And then maybe a Thursday or something, I'll play in the afternoon, we'll play a match. But it really depends, because I like to play, you know, at least a couple sets a week just to be like match ready. And I think, you know, this is very specific to each player, but I think I play my best tennis when I've played a lot of matches. You know, tend to play my best tennis closer to the end of the tournament rather than beginning. But yeah, so it's really important for me to, before I'm playing a tournament, you know, I'm playing the Vero Beach 15K next week. I'm probably going to play, you know, a match on Saturday, a couple sets on Sunday, and just be prepared. But during the week, yeah, I'll go morning 9 to 11:30, 2.5 hours, and I'll try and get, you know, a set or two in the middle of the week.
Mm-hmm. And your school is in the evenings or in the afternoons?
Right. So I actually do an online school where you Skype your teacher and everything. So it's the closest thing to traditional school. So I have class times that I've organized with, you know, other kids in my class and the teacher as well. So like, if I'll give you like a regular Monday, my class schedule would be, I'd have a class at, you know, 8 a.m. and then I'd have a class at 6 and 8 p.m. So I would have to, you know, schedule my work in between those times. It's difficult. Yeah. But, you know, I tend to manage it pretty well.
Cooper, what is that school called?
It's actually called Dwight Global. They have a private school in New York called Dwight, and they have an online program as well that they usually use for, you know, I mean, the kids in my class, there's a girl who's on a Netflix show. There's 2 ballet dancers. I think there's 1 other tennis player and there's a skier. So, you know, it's
gotcha.
There's another tennis player that works with me, Cooper.
Yeah, Lisa Tachenko. She actually works with Richard, and she goes. She's actually in my AP Lang class too. So,
all right. So let me ask you a kind of an off the wall question. But I got this exact question from a listener. They've got a young lady who's very good, and they want to transition her into ITF and maybe even some future challenger type events. And she's got the ability to do it. But they kind of saw the ITF schedule and the website and all that kind of daunting. They couldn't really figure out where the tournaments were. The website was kind of hard to navigate. Can you just give some advice as you transitioned into ITF and maybe even future tournaments? Mm-hmm. How you found them, you know, how often you played them, where they are. Because, you know, one of the things they said is like, man, they're nowhere near where they live. So can you kind of just talk about that, the tournament scene that you're in right now?
Right. Of course. You know, I couldn't agree more. The programming for the ITF page could be a lot better. You know, there's definitely a lot of room for improvement there. But when it comes to just, it all comes down to picking the right tournaments. To be honest, I played my first three ITFs in Canada, which is, you know, it's pretty close. You know, I tended to do very well. I did very well in both. So I got the points I needed to be able to play higher level tournaments. But, you know, if you want to play ITFs, you're going to have to travel. You know, that's, you know, you'd have to go to South America. You'll have to play Central America. You might have to go to Europe for a few. You know, I don't know this girl. I don't know her, you know, her level, but I'm assuming, as you said, she's very good. So if she has the level, she'll be able to travel to, you know, Central America, play a grade three, maybe go to Europe for a grade one, play one or two in South America. But yeah, you know, you're going to have to commit some time to traveling. But the goal is that you only have to travel for a certain period of time, like 6 months, like of just, you know, really putting in the work. And then it kind of, you know, dies down because your ranking's high enough where you don't have to really go to all those successive tournaments.
Yeah,
exactly. So you'll have, you know, that point baseline where you can make all grade ones and twos just relatively easily. There's no reason to travel for, you know, a distant grade four. But yeah, it's very important to pick the right tournaments to where you think you can do well. And I know people are going to say cherry picking and stuff, but the thing is, you know, the closer you get to Europe, the harder the tournaments are going to be, in my opinion, from speaking from experience. But yeah, there are good players everywhere. So you're never going to find a tournament that's just, you know, just bum week. But the thing is, you have to play the right tournaments, and you have to put the time in, you have to put the travel in. And if you do it for a long enough, you know, a well-placed period of time, you know, you get 6-7 good tournaments in back, you know, not back to back, but, you know, in a couple months or, you know, 6 months, you will really have the ranking to show for it, and the travel will die down. Because next year, you know, after the drop off of ranking, you know, I'll be able to make slams, and I won't have to travel for the same amount of tournaments I did this year, because my ranking will be high enough to where people won't pass me all the time, you know? So it's not like where you're at the 300s where, you know, you lose a point and five people go ahead of you, and, you know, you'll be at 50, 60 where, you know, you're 100 points ahead of the guy in front of you or the guy behind you. So it's, but yeah, that's, you know, the general advice is pick the right tournaments and commit to a couple. And if you do well, then it'll pay off.
Right. Yeah. Like they say, you know, the results speak for themselves. You know, if you had the results, you'll get to where you want to be. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also difficult because you go to these tournaments and you're like, you definitely don't want to lose first round. You went all this way.
That's the hard thing. You know, like say, you know, you go there somewhere, you play Monday, maybe you get the first seed or something like that, and you're out of the tournament. And what do you do for the rest of the week? And, you know, it's a tough thing to do because the tournaments run, you know, Monday through Friday. Right. So it's, you mean, you're committed into an entire week and you just don't know how it's going to go.
The great thing is, you know, every single other person there is feeling the exact same way.
Right.
Nobody wants to lose first round. These kids came all this way to get those get the same points you're fighting for. And it's, you know, it's a very competitive environment, obviously, because these kids are foreign or, you know, wherever they're from, but you make good friends because it's like, you're in the same boat, you know, like some of my best friends are, you know, there's a kid from Mexico that I play doubles with every time I play, you know, in Central America, wherever. And we've won like two grade threes together. So it's great. You know, you make good friends. But yes, you know, I think going to these tournaments, very daunting, you know, looking at it. And it's, but I mean, if you have the level and you have the commitment, you should be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, I do want to hear one story your mom told me about when I think you're playing maybe San Salvador and it was really windy and a tree fell on the court. What happened there? What happened?
Right. So I believe it was like 3-all in the third set or something. And I, you know, I wasn't playing my best tennis. This was, I believe, last year. I was 15. You know, I kind of really just started getting into ITFs and stuff, like really starting to commit to it. And I was just like, I'm not having it today. It's 40-mile-per-hour winds. It's like a tornado out here. How are people expecting to play tennis? And so it's 3-all. We're in the middle of the rally. And I lose the point. I'm whatever. I'm walking back to the fence. And I hear crack. And this, you know, giant chunk of the tree, like full branch, you know, 3 feet wide, crashes onto the court. In the middle of a windstorm. I mean, chairs were flying previously. I was like, you know, whatever. There's this tree. It gives a bit of shade. So I was, it was hot. So I'd be sitting, you know, under the tree in the shade. And that tree pretty much fully collapsed onto the court. And the great thing was, they didn't take it off the court. They swept it to the side. So I'm not swept it. I understate there. They pushed it. They had to get four guys out there to push it to the side of the court. So we continued play with, you know, a 400-pound tree on our court.
No excuses, and right? Find
no, a way. No. I ended up losing that match too. And I 100% blamed it on the tree.
So, there you go.
But yeah, there's going to be a lot of stories like that. I mean, yeah, anybody who travels for ITFs, you're definitely going to come home with stories.
That's fun. Well, hey, let's go back to Richard. Richard, one of the questions that we have is, what do you think is one of the most, and you may have hit on it earlier, but maybe we can just address it, you know, full on, but what's one of the most neglected aspects of tennis conditioning?
I would say, gosh, people miss quite a few, but I think that a lot of the stability training, stability work that we do would be something that, you know, it's not really glamorous. It doesn't necessarily look good on Instagram, but it's a thing that we need to get done, on a pretty consistent basis. And that's your hip stability and shoulder stability.
And how do you work on, say, shoulder stability?
Some of the different isometric trainings that we'll do. For example, like doing a high plank with one arm and you've got your other arm behind your back, a couple of different positions like that.
Okay. Yeah.
That type of thing. And also like for the shoulder specifically, doing a lot of eccentric work, replicating the follow through on the serve. We mentioned, and a little bit of this goes together too, some of the deceleration stuff, all those muscles in the back of the shoulder, those are the ones that actually slow down your arm. So, when you have like a rotator cuff injury, and this is what happened to me when I was in school. It's not from the acceleration up to hit the serve. It's on the deceleration part. It's once you make contact, and then you're slowing your arm down, or same thing like on your forehand. So doing some of that eccentric work and some of the isometric work is really important for that.
Okay, good. And what do you think? Go ahead, Robert.
And that stuff can be done simple with just a band, right?
I mean, absolutely. Yeah.
I see a lot of players who hook a band to the net, and then they're basically taking their fist from their belly button out away from the net, right? And then same when they put it up kind of in a throwing position and pull it away from the net, anything you can do to work that, the back of that shoulder, it sounds real fancy, isometric, right? When people are listening, right. But it's just bands. It's nothing that's very difficult, right?
Right. It's very simple. It's stuff that, you know, that you should be doing as part of your warm up every time before you go on court, before you practice, before you play a match. And you know, just a couple of things that would be like an end range motion. And so that would be like, for example, you've got the band and your arms at 90 degrees down by your side. And then you bring your arm up as far as you can while keeping your shoulder, elbow and wrist all in alignment. And you hit that top position and you pause for a beat and then you slowly lower it back down. But that's working into that end range motion. One of the things too that I see with a lot of junior players is I'm happy when I see them doing their band warmups before they play, before they practice, but you can tell sometimes that they're just going through the motions and they aren't really thinking about what they're doing, you know, not making that mind body connection. And that's something that I think is really important. And that's something that is often overlooked as well.
Richard, one of the things, sorry, Scott, one of the things, Richard, I noticed is the kids who always do their bands the best are the ones who just got injured and they just got back healthy. And now they're like all in their bands, right? Is that kind of what you've seen too?
Yes. Yes. It's funny how that works. It reminds me of the, the Valvoline commercials, is you can pay me now or you can pay me later.
Exactly.
One or the other, isn't that right? Yeah.
And yeah. I know, Richard, I'm not the best at it. You know, I don't, you know, it's not my forte. And he doesn't let me off about it. So
we've had negotiations as to how long this should take. Like, Cooper, come on, give me 8 minutes before you play to warm up.
I'm like can six, give max.
Five. It's six. Yeah. Okay. Come on. Six and a half.
So Cooper, have you had any sort of serious injuries where it's kept you out of play and practice for a period of time?
Serious? No, I've actually, you know, despite, you know, Richard bashing me, no, but yeah. Richard's been doing a great job. I've been with Richard, I haven't felt more than an ache in my knee, so credit to him. But previously, never really had, you know, something that's put me out for a while. I played 14s hard courts with something that was wrong with my foot. I ended up winning the tournament, and then we went home, and I ended up realizing I had a stress fracture in my foot. But that only took me out for 6 weeks. I started playing again. I was fine.
Okay.
But, you know, this is weird, actually. Most of my, you know, minor injuries come from playing, you know, external sports. So I was playing ping pong, you know, like I broke my toe or something. Something ridiculous like that. But to answer your question, no, I've never really had a knock on wood, but I've never really had, you know, something that's put me out for a while.
Yeah. Well, Richard, you know, I went to ASU, and I know that you worked with Murphy Cassone, who just signed with ASU. Yeah. So I was wondering if you could just tell me, you know, and you had a really nice post after he was made number one in the country or something like that. But you had a real nice post about the time that you spent working with him. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how he developed over the years of working with you.
That was Murphy became the number one recruit on tennisrecruiting.com, I guess. And that's the post to which you were referring.
Right.
Murphy came to me when he was 15. And so he turned 19 in August. So I've been working with him for about a little over 4 years. And I mean, I'm really proud of where he is now. I'm really proud of him for all the work that he put in. He came in, he was, you know, maybe a little awkward. He had grown and was, you know, kind of, he needed some proprioception work. Let's put it that way. He needed to feel his body out a little bit and get comfortable with it. But he worked and still does extremely hard. I mean, just really, really dedicated. We would often talk about even when he was trying hard, sometimes he would do something a little off. And so we started referring to it as Murph 17, because this was back in 2017. And we would compare Murph 20, Murph 21 to Murph 17. But he's a kid that he was doing 6 a.m., 7 a.m. workouts 5 days a week. That was the dedication that he had. He knew that this was something that he needed to add to his game. And you know, he it's funny, and all that time he was maybe about a year into it, and he stood me up. Something happened one day. It wasn't his fault, and one day he just overslept, like literally the next day he overslept. And I told him, I said you know, I'm not gonna do this. You're not respecting my time. And so I put him in the afternoon. I made him come in the afternoon for the rest of that week. And starting back that following Monday, I let him come back to 6 a.m. and he never missed another one. He never was late again. And he also really understood what we were talking about earlier of training through tournaments. He would be gone and I would sit workouts on the road that he would do consistently. You know, and you know, even now he'll send me something, he'll shoot me a text and say, hey, can you send me a movement workout for today? You know, we just did some weights today, but I feel like I need to do some movement work. So he's done such a great job. He has worked so hard to get to where he is, and I'm really, really proud of him.
That's awesome.
So you guys have got a good one there at ASU.
Well, good. I'm looking forward to having that for a few years. That's awesome.
I do the 2 p.m. workout with Richard, if you were wondering.
I got the impression. Good. Well, I know that Cooper has to run off to a class here real quick. So maybe we just have time for one or two more questions. Robert, you want to go ahead with one?
Oh, I think this is great. I think there will be a lot of parents who get a ton of understanding just from listening to you both. Richard, you're clearly an expert at what you do. And Cooper, did you say you're 16?
I am. I turned 16 in June.
I mean, clearly super, you know, how do you say it? Super mature, super impressive. So kudos to both of y'all, but also kudos, Cooper, to your parents, right? I mean, I can tell they've done a really good job with you. And so I think
don't let them know that though.
Well, tonight when we hang up, why don't you go give them a hug? Because you can tell they're really giving you the best opportunity to be successful.
They did a great job. Yeah. They're still doing a great job.
I can tell you got that teenager in you, though. You're like, yeah, whatever.
Just a little
bit. Sisters take care of that.
I am the middle child. I get enough negative attention. You know?
Yes, it sounds like it. Well, hey, so before we sign off, Cooper, next week you're going to be at the Vero Beach Futures, and then what do you have the rest of the year?
Right, so I'll play Vero Beach next week. I'm in qualies for that. It's obviously very strong because it's a US 15K. So
right.
But yeah, so after Vero Beach, I will probably play Grade 1 Guadalajara, the Grade A in Merida, Eddie Herr and Orange Bowl, and maybe a futures in somewhere in the mix of those tournaments. But wow, those are the four big ones that close out the year for me.
That's huge. Well, good luck in all of that. We'll definitely follow you for that. And Richard, tell us where people can find more about you. I know that you have a great Instagram page, and almost daily there's exercises on there that are really good to use. I know that I take them out to the court with my son and I say, hey, let's do what Cooper's doing here. So tell us how people can find out more about you, your raw tennis performance.
Raw tennis perform. It's RAW10S perform is my Instagram. So raw tennis perform on Instagram. And I have a website. It's not updated very often, but it's rawtennisperformance.com, and you can find me there. The best way is to reach out on Instagram.